wait a second. Before we attack each other and tear ourselves to shreds like a pack of maniacs, let's just open the sack first and see what's actually in it. It might not even be worth the trouble.
What do you think? I'm not sure.
Maybe.
Hi.
A rancid apple core, two worm-eaten banana peels, a moldy rice cake, a dried-up pickle, tin of sardine bones, a pile of broken eggshells, an old smushed-up rotten gizzard with maggots all over it.
Okay, it's worth it.
That was a scene from the Wes Anderson movie Isle of Dogs, which features animation expertise from our guest today. Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts scene. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm joined today by a sculptor, a designer, and an animation producer and director, Paul Herod. Welcome back to the show.
Hi there, Conj.
It's been a while, but when was the last time you were in the studio with
us? I think that might have been 8 or 9 years ago. It was to talk about the film screenings at Mother's that I host monthly. And I think it was back when I was still showing Italian Westerns, so they were spaghetti Western nights.
Anyway, yes, I want to ask you about this animated feature film that's been put together by Wes Anderson, along with a redoubtable team of animators, artists, fabricators, and set builders. But first, let me set the stage, so to speak. It's 2015, and you're at the Burning Man Arts Festival in Nevada. You've left the business world behind. You're roaming the endless playa, blue skies above, and then your cell phone goes off.
Yeah. Normally, when I go to Burning Man, I turn off the phone. It's my timepiece and a camera, but not a communication device. But on this occasion, I was checking the weather, happened to notice that there was an email from somebody who mentioned my friend Nelson Lowry. And I said, well, what's that about? Nelson, as you know.
Well, he's a production designer
at Leica.
For Kubo and Two Strings, yeah?
He was the production designer on Kubo, as well as Paranorman, but prior to that, he'd been production designer on Fantastic Mr. Fox and art director on Corpse Bride. He's a very dear friend of mine, and because he was doing Kubo, he was unavailable to do the production design on Isle of Dogs, but he recommended me. So I look at this email, and with a very spotty cell signal, I'm able to make contact with Jeremy Dawson, the producer, and Jeremy wants to send me a copy of the script and an animatic of about the first 35 minutes of the film. And there's no way I can download or look at any of this stuff while I'm in Black Rock City. So I hitched a ride out in the middle of a dust storm. I had a little sign saying Reno. The very first car that passed me picked me up, which was really nice. Dropped me off at the Reno airport, and I flew back to Portland where I could download the script. And I was just thrilled because I thought the script was just incredible. But I figured they had a lot of other people they were looking at. But yeah, about 3 days later, I'm on the phone with Wes Anderson. And about 4 days after that, I'm on a plane to London. So it was go, go, go. And I certainly didn't have any time to settle any affairs before going, but went straight into it. It was basically at the point when they had moved into 3 Mill Studios in East London. So Adam Stockhausen had been working on the film since maybe April or May, but he was moving on to work on Ready Player One, Steven Spielberg's film. So he just did the mind meld with me, and I took it over from that point. And I was there throughout most of the shooting. It continued for about 3-4 months after I left, but all the designs were pretty much nailed at that point.
So like a good animator, you just moved into the style that Adam Stockhausen had established when he was production designer then.
Yeah, Adam and Wes. I mean, If you've seen Wes Anderson's films, you know that there is a style there, a very distinct style. And the way that images are composed, it's something that belongs very much to him. And so he is very, very involved in the whole design approach.
Well, I don't know how hands-on Wes was with Isle of Dogs. There are tales of him Skyping in from France to the set of Fantastic Mr. Fox back in the day. So did the animation team have a lot of leeway?
No, not really. The thing is that Wes wasn't necessarily on set all that much, but he was on the film pretty much 24/7. It was astounding. I mean, I probably shared 15 emails with him a day.
Wow.
So it was almost like a regular conversation. You know, on the occasions when he would come to visit the set, you could tell that he just loved this stuff. And he was almost giddy with delight at everything that he saw. And I think by being in a remote location and just, you know, having stuff sent to him and being able to respond on email actually allowed him to maintain a certain coolness, to not necessarily show the enthusiasm that he was probably feeling. And it was a way of making sure that we gave him precisely what he had in mind, and to not ever say, well, that's really beautiful, let's go with that. It gave him a certain amount of leeway to be less seduced immediately by what we were offering up. It wasn't always easy, and people would wonder why we were doing it this way. And my mantra throughout the whole production was, hey, there's only one person on this project who knows how to make a Wes Anderson film, and you're not it.
One of our recent guests here on Words and Pictures was Mark Gustafson, the animation director on Wes Anderson's Fantastic Mr. Fox. He also collaborated with the great Guillermo del Toro on Pinocchio. And Mark had kind of a similar story to yours about getting hired. Apparently, Wes's first choice for Fantastic Mr. Fox was Henry Selick. Henry had already done some animated sequences for The Life Aquatic. But when Wes called, he was busy with Coraline. So Mark's name came up, he got the job, and did absolutely yeoman work.
Yeah.
And Wes and Mark were both big fans of Willis O'Brien, the stop-motion animator for the original King Kong.
Yeah, Wes actually referenced King Kong a lot while we were working on this, mostly in terms of how foreground-background relationships were established, you know, filling in the corners of the frame and kind of vignetting certain shots with some kind of strong foreground detail. So he would reference a lot of those beautiful shots in King Kong that involved glass paintings and multiple layers of glass paintings of foliage and that sort of thing. Not that he wanted it to particularly look just like that, because, of course, we were creating a land that had no vegetation, but that was one of his reference points for certain compositions.
Yeah, tell us about the landscape. Simon Weiss, who was the incredible set builder who did the miniatures for the Grand Budapest Hotel, he was there building these epic landscapes. So there were two main landscapes, Megasaki City and Trash Island.
Right. Well, it became quickly apparent that we weren't building sets in the traditional sense. We were building shots. So when you see the film, what you're going to notice is that there are some grand views that we see in a single shot, and we never see that particular view again. By the time we did a final set count, it was around 225 sets. And we decided that what we would focus on at Three Mills Studios was to build all the sets that animation took place on. Whereas Simon in Berlin would take on a lot of our wider views, places where we don't necessarily have animation occurring on the set.
You just have these big Wes Anderson-style establishing shots of this world that he's created.
Yeah, and in some cases there was animation because we had a range of puppet scales, and at a certain point we actually started producing figures that weren't much more than about a half an inch tall. And we would actually sometimes place those in those sets. But Simon's team built some absolutely amazing stuff, including the establishing shot of Megasaki City that opens the film that's really quite beautiful. But he also created a lot of our initial establishing shots of Trash Island. And on Trash Island, we travel from zone to zone. It was a very interesting design process because...
Yeah, each zone has its own unique color scheme and arrangement of characters.
Yeah. Well, the initial inspiration for a lot of these, particularly establishing shots and these tableaus, was the ukiyo-e illustrations from 19th century Japan, images by Hokusai and Hiroshige of oftentimes pastoral landscapes, but interesting, you know, sort of epic landscapes as well, land bridges and these images at the edges of an archipelago. And the idea was to take those kinds of compositions, to create something like that, but instead of a pastoral image of nature, they would instead be completely dominated by trash. And then, because a sizable part of the film is essentially a journey from one part of Trash Island to another, we wanted to distinguish these zones. So in the very first scene where our hero pack, the main dog characters, are introduced, the tones are all rust, and it's all just big piles of rusty metal and puddles of copper-colored mud that's sort of moist. And we were drawing a lot from the photography of Edward Bertinsky, who is somebody who has documented these sort of trash and junk landscapes, the sort of crisis that humanity is facing with the disposal of trash. But his photographs have this incredible beauty to them. It was an interesting way of approaching the trash. We wanted each of the images to have this beautiful, hellish landscape. It would look seductive and horrifying at the same time. So we have this one landscape that's all rust, another one that is all white. It's all paper. It's just like a vast landscape that's nothing but newspapers that have been strewn all over the place. Another one, as Wes and I sort of explored what the color scheme would be, he suggested, well, I think I want this particular landscape to be black. So what I came up with was that it would be composed entirely of old car batteries and broken cathode ray tubes. And so there's a particular scene with a fight between the dogs and the dog catchers on this particular beach. And it's in this bowl-shaped landscape. And if you look carefully, you see that it is all entirely batteries and cathode ray tubes. I was really kind of inspired by some sets in Satyricon.
Fellini's Satyricon, right?
Yeah. I am a huge fan of Danilo Donati, too, one of the great production designers who did Satyricon and Casanova, a lot of Fellini's films.
Now, if you're accosted by a seatmate on an airplane who asks you, what's the job of a production designer, what do you say? What's your pitch?
Well, it can it can be a range of things. The production designer, strictly speaking, is the person who is driving the look of the film. And in the case of working with Wes Anderson, it is a very tight collaboration with the director to drive that look. A production designer is a draftsperson, an architect, an archivist, a researcher, somebody who leads the team. You have people like Ken Adam, one of the truly great production designers. He was a production designer on Dr. Strangelove and a lot of the earlier Bond films. He was an incredible draftsperson, an artist, and all of his sets he personally drew himself. So he was also a concept illustrator as well as a draftsperson. I much prefer to give the concept illustration to somebody who's a much better artist than I am. I tend to work a lot with research, and I'll compile a lot of references and maybe do a rough composition that I give to the concept illustrator to really render out. And then the concept illustrator brings a lot to the plate too, and just figures out oftentimes the best placement of things within that frame. And then we have to sort of figure it out architecturally, because the concept illustrator has done it two-dimensionally, and that's where I come back in, and I often build the foam core mock-ups myself. On this film, we had so many that I wasn't really able to. I built the first couple of them with some of the artists, and once they knew how I liked to construct these things, I could pretty much just set up the camera. They would build the foam core mock-up, and there would be a lot of back and forth with Wes, and finally settle on an image that has a three-dimensional construct. And then we go in and everyone would talk about issues like animator access. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that really distinguishes stop-motion animation is that you have to take that into account with every set you build, is how the animator is going to get in there and move the characters around. You can build a 360-degree set on a live-action film, and you know the characters move themselves on that. But on stop motion, you know, this person who is pretty big in comparison to the character has to be able to get in there. And some sets we would build so that they could just climb on top of it, and they would have to be pretty bulletproof. Others, you create little trap doors and hatchways in various parts of the set. In some cases, you will actually split the set in half, and the animator can actually just work on this half of the set while the other one isn't even there, and then you put it back together, and then in VFX, you make it look like the set was one complete thing.
Yeah, well, it sounds like this studio in London that you're working in was not just chock-a-block with talented craftspeople, but also with art scholars who were looking to these influences from the past and the present to build this world.
Absolutely. Well, we had these amazing concept artists that we worked with. Turlo Griffin, Victor Georgiev, both of whom had worked on Fantastic Mr. Fox, and Carl Sprague, working out of New York. I think he was art director on the Royal Tenenbaums. They were providing us with just gorgeous artwork. Turlo's was really interesting because we would tend to give him a lot of the more organic kinds of forms. And he had this great technique of working in negative space. So he would work on black paper and white Conti crayon. He was just drawing highlights, which was, it was so evocative. And even though some of the images, when you look closely, were kind of abstract, they just gave you a great sense of what the tone we needed to go for would be. And then Victor's work tended to be a lot more mechanical, so we gave him a lot of architecture and vehicles. We came up with these great amphibious vehicles for the municipal task force to ride around in that were really a lot of fun.
You know, London and Portland share more than just sloppy weather. There's a huge talent base of stop-motion animators, and it's interesting that there are two feature films that are very Japanese-inflected that have come out very close to each other, Kubo and the Two Strings and Isle of Dogs.
Yeah, no, the coincidence wasn't lost on any of us. It was pretty interesting. And the fact that Nelson and I are, you know, good friends, we do a certain amount of comparing of notes. It was pretty interesting that we were both working on these films at the same time. But yeah, the talent pool on this film is very international. The animators were coming from all over the place, a few from Portland and other places in the U.S., but we also had talent from Belgium, France, Spain, just all over Europe. I had a graphics artist, Chinami Narakawa, who I brought over from Japan, too. It was very important on this to have, particularly in the graphics department, to have Japanese people. And Erica Dorn had sort of headed up the graphics department. She grew up in Japan and is Japanese and French. And it was nice to get her perspective on things because she would not only be able to tell us whether something did or did not jibe in terms of being accurate to Japanese culture, but she also had an understanding of how an outsider would see things because she's lived in London for 10 years. And so she really was able to see things from both sides. The interesting thing I found with the crew that I was working with in the art department and fabrication area is that if they're not working on one of these animated films, which is a decidedly smaller production, they're working on big, big films. They'll be on like a Star Wars film or a James Bond film. And we had people who had come off of prop making in both of those areas. But also a lot of the puppet makers, they're very well-rounded and they will also work on these feature films that don't necessarily have, that don't have stop motion in them, but they have such a wide range of skills that they can move over into working on props and sets on these big features being shot over at Pinewood. Pinewood being the big place where the largest film productions in London are really happening. And so we would have people working for a while with us, and then they would say, well, I'm going to work on the Han Solo movie or something like that next.
Well, the thing you hear about Wes Anderson is that he really likes the hand-hewn, hand-sculpted look, more analog than digital. So I suppose the people who were making models, making sets, they might have gotten more of their work on screen than, say, other productions where there would be computer-generated effects up front.
That's true. At the same time, some of the very elaborate sets that we worked on appear for a second, in some cases less than a second. It's pretty amazing the amount of material that was generated for certain sequences. There's one where that's a traveling sequence, and one part of it involved six different sort of bas-relief sculptures as the background. He wanted it to take on a slightly dimensional, slightly graphic quality there, and to not necessarily feel like the deep, deep sets that we had in a lot of other scenes. And there were also places where we moved very quickly. There are dolly shots across certain sets that have a huge amount of detail that you don't really get to see at all. I think this is going to be one to really invite people when the Blu-ray comes out to just go through certain scenes frame at a time. Otherwise, you're just not going to see it.
Well, the history of cultural exchange between Japan and the West goes back centuries. You go back to the 19th century, and there were heavy influences between the Impressionists and the Tokyo School. And in the film world, of course, there's Akira Kurosawa and Jean-Pierre Melville. There's Shohei Imamura and Quentin Tarantino. That said, I do hear from some young artists who are a bit more leery these days. So was there ever a concern while you were building the world of Megasaki City that there might be accusations of cultural appropriation?
Yeah, always. I think that's always sort of something at the back of your mind. And I think our answer to that was to try to honor the history of Japanese art and Japanese cinema as much as we possibly could. Look, I have to say that, you know, particularly with art and film, I think the work of Kurosawa and of Hokusai are gifts to the world. And, you know, I can't speak for those artists, but I have to think that they would feel kind of the same way. And the fact is, cultural appropriation is something that goes back pretty far. And in fact, some of the people who we as filmmakers are accused of appropriating, in fact, appropriated themselves.
Well, I know that you're a fan of Yasujirō Ozu, the iconic director of Tokyo Story, started out making silent films. Well, he's considered the most Japanese of film directors, but certainly there are still some Western influences in his early work, especially his comedies.
Yeah, his comedies are, you know, the Ozu's pre-war output feels like an entirely different filmmaker from the post-war output. I think the work that he did post-war really was very much about trying to hold on to Japan, the Japan that he knew, before it disappeared completely. And in fact, I certainly owe a great debt of gratitude to Ozu for creating these domestic scenes and giving us a sense of what the average person's life was like, particularly in the post-war period, because Tokyo Story especially, I think, is such a rich, rich portrait of what life in Japan was like in the 4 or 5 years following the war. And it's interesting. I think Kurosawa was a little bit different. I think he really embraced the Western influence a lot more. And then you have Kon Ichikawa, who might be, he was criticized, I think, in Japan for being a bit of an apologist for what led to the rise of the Japanese Empire, you know, with films like The Burmese Harp. But yes, Ozu was a key influence. And when you see the film, there will be a few tableaus that you'll notice that are distinctly inspired by Ozu. And I think that was appropriate because Ozu and Wes Anderson have been compared by a number of people, more than just just compositional elements. It's like the way that he worked with a recurring cast of actors, all kinds of things. And Wes said maybe Ozu and I share a lot of the same sort of peculiarities. And I'd been thinking about it all along. We had a montage of domestic scenes, and I was definitely drawing from mostly Ozu's later color films in putting those together.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm talking today with animation director and producer Paul Harrod. He's back in Portland after 2 years in England, heading up production design on the Wes Anderson feature Isle of Dogs. I should mention, your partner of many years is the very talented filmmaker Joanna Priestley. Joanna has been a frequent guest on the show. I don't suppose it was easy for the two of you to be separated for 2 years by an ocean. Here's the part where you say, well, of course, it was terrible.
Yeah. Well, it was. I mean, that was probably the most difficult thing on this project. It was stressful. I mean, to be away from home for that long a period of time. Fortunately, Joanna was able to work in some of her travels to European film festivals in with time that she could spend with me. So she would go to a film festival, say in Vienna or Stuttgart, and I'd meet with her on the weekend, and then she'd come back, and so we would have, you know, a couple weeks in London together. And that was great because there's so much to do in London.
But you didn't have a whole lot of time for sightseeing.
No, not really. Although, I gotta say, I bought a bike almost as soon as I got there. And I got to know London really well via bicycle. That was my weekends. My weekends would be, you know, Saturday morning I would hop on the bicycle and just explore London. And after 2 years, I really got to know my way around the city pretty well. But yeah, you know, when you're living alone in London, in my case, having been married for 26 years, you keep on wanting to be able to share this with your partner when you go to see an amazing play someplace, Imelda Staunton doing Gypsy or whatever, and you just wish, my partner was here to see this with me. So when she would come to visit me, we saw a lot of theater.
Well, I want to ask you about one of the, possibly the greatest Saturday morning show of the 1980s, Pee-wee's Playhouse. You put together the original opening sequence for the show.
Actually, that's not really true. The original opening sequence was done at Broadcast Arts. And in fact, David Daniels, who I've known since college and we've worked together over the years. Yeah, we went to Cal Arts together. He did a lot of the animation for that sequence. The first, second, and third season had the same opening. I came in when they moved from New York to Los Angeles. I was making props, building sets for their animated sequences like the fridge sequence and the dinosaur family and that sort of thing. And Paul Rubin wanted to expand on the opening title sequence. And so I showed Prudence Fenton, our animation producer, some work that I'd done when I was at Cal Arts with forced perspective miniature landscapes. And they originally asked, well, can we use that landscape for this opening sequence? And I said, no, let me build you something new that's specific to this. And so I built a couple of landscapes, one which was a little woodsy location with a lake in the foreground, and another one was like an African savanna with rhinoceri with this big almost Ayers Rock type rock formation in the background. And we also reshot the playhouse itself. That 2 had been built at Broadcast Arts and had been shipped over, and Paul Rubin wanted to get a much wider view of this, so I basically reconstructed all the landscape surrounding the playhouse for that sequence. Unfortunately, the opening title sequence was delayed. It was going to be for the 4th and 5th season, so the 4th season didn't get those miniatures in there, but the 5th season did, but the show was canceled after the first episode because of an incident in Florida that involved Paul Rubin in a movie theater that some people might remember.
Let's talk about the PJs. This is a TV series that you directed several episodes of. It started out in the late 90s, lasted 3 short seasons, and it's still talked about with great fondness today. It might have been ahead of its time, sort of like Freaks and Geeks or Firefly, but yeah, it got switched around between networks.
Yeah, the PJs was an amazing experience. I was the production designer on the first season of that show, but after directing an episode, I sort of became a full-time director on it. And Will Vinton Studios at that point started gathering animation talent from all over the country. And the sort of massive influx of stop-motion talent into Portland, I think, really built a head of steam during the production of that show. And it was at a time when there was still, I think, in network animation, an interest in visual quality, partially because of who was making it. You know, Eddie Murphy and Ron Howard and Brian Grazier were...
The writing talent included Eddie Murphy, Steve Tompkins, and Larry Wilmore of the late lamented Nightly Show.
Yeah, yeah.
Comedy Central.
And, well, Larry and Steve were the showrunners. And they were just great to work with. I really had a good time working with them. They gave us a remarkable amount of latitude as directors in terms of allowing us to, you know, really stretch ourselves visually. And it wasn't, at the time, not a cheap show to produce. And we built quite an array of diverse sets, and it had a pretty diverse cast.
I should mention that the setting for the series was based on the Cabrini-Green housing projects in Chicago. The PJs is shorthand for the projects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we referenced Cabrini-Green, sort of the exterior architecture, but also the film that Frederick Weissman made about the Ida B. Wells projects was also a huge influence on more on our interiors. Yeah, it was just a great project to design and produce. We had just an amazing team of artists, and a lot of the people who worked on that have went on to take on very key positions at Leica. John Ashley was one of our LCs, and he shot Box Trolls. And Brad Schiff, who's pretty much the key animation supervisor at Leica, was one of our animators.
Yeah, there was another stop-motion series that Vinton produced around the same time, Gary and Mike, The Adventures of Two Slackers Traveling Around the Country. And it was really a 1-2 punch to the local animation scene when the PJs and Gary and Mike both got canceled.
It was rough. I think it was sort of a perfect storm. One thing that became a real issue at that time was that reality TV was starting to happen. And the networks realized with shows like Survivor that the cost of an hour of reality television was half the cost of a half-hour sitcom or animated show. And so, you know, it just allowed them to produce a lot more content. And so animation took a big blow. Content in general took a big blow, or at least original content. But animation was one of the first things to kind of suffer from that. And the result was that animation had to be produced much, much more cheaply at that point. And so the shows that did survive that period were ones that were incredibly cheap to produce and done very, very quickly. And also, I think that there was a sense that an animated show should almost function like a radio show with visuals. So you...
That just seems wrong.
Well, yeah, but if you take South Park, you could take the visual away from it and it would almost have the same impact. It really is the writing that is driving that and the voice talent. And with the shows that we were doing, that wasn't really so much the case. It was much, much more dependent upon the visual component.
Well, occasionally TV will air an animated special. One of the ones that you worked on was called Edith Ann, Life in the Little Lane, written by the legendary Lily Tomlin and her partner Jane Wagner. That must have been an interesting project to work on.
It was. Of course, interestingly, that show that was finally aired was very different from what I had worked on, which was a stop-motion series. Again, David Daniels was tapped by Lily and Jane to direct this show, and he brought me in as a designer. And we built a number of sets in Lily and Jane's garage. And I spent probably 9 months working on that, and I was helping them market it. But at the time, they were getting a lot of pushback on the idea of doing a stop-motion series. They were told that stop-motion had no future. And we even went to Hanna-Barbera, and one of the executive producers there said, well, you know, people can't look at stop-motion for more than the space of a TV commercial. It doesn't work as program content. And, you know, I just sort of rolled my eyes. And it was very depressing in LA at that time to just constantly get all this pushback saying that stop motion had no future, which has been proven wrong, I'm happy to say. But in the end, they produced a 2D animated show, and they used some of the sets that I built as sort of photographic elements for these scenes where Edith Ann is kind of imagining her life and her world. But it would have been great. I was really proud of the work that I did designing and building these sets for that world, and I was very sorry that we never were able to realize it completely.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And my guest today has been animation director and producer Paul Harrod. His latest project as production designer is the animated feature film Isle of Dogs, directed by Wes Anderson. Paul, it's been great to have you join us today on Words and Pictures.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Now, for our listeners who might be interested in your other projects, how can they find out more?
Well, they can visit my website, paulharrod.com, and there you can see both my work as a director and as a designer.
Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter @wordsandpicture.